Good evening, everyone. Welcome to tonight's webinar. It's entitled, How Medications Can Help a Good Plan Work Better, presented by Dr. Josh Sader. Did I say that correctly, sir?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernotitis. I have a 13-year-old son with autism, and I've been very active in the autism community since he was diagnosed at the age of 4. I've served as the president of the Autism Society of America Dayton chapter, and I've worked as the assistive technology specialist for Goodwill Easter Seals. I'm also a regular contributor to Autism Today. There are two ways to listen to tonight's webinar. You can log in to momsfightingautism.com, and this is one of the presentations that's in the Autism Conference scheduled for April 9th and 10th. So register for that, and you'll be able to participate. The webinar is completely free. Once registered, you'll see a blue box in the upper left-hand corner of your screen. There you can click Listen In and hear the discussion via the Internet. You can also click Ask a Question, and you can submit a question through the website for our speaker. You can also listen in by phone by calling 949-333-4806 and enter conference ID number 168-978-pound. All callers are immediately muted, so don't worry about background noises. We can't hear you. Later in our webinar, I'll let you know, as a telephone listener, how you can ask a question if you'd wish. We try to get to as many of our questions and our common topics as we can in the time we have allotted. If you don't get your question answered, I'm sure there's going to be a way for you to contact Dr. Fader afterwards, so you can ask your questions then. When the slideshow begins, Internet users can go to their blue box and click Slides to view the slideshow. It takes a moment to connect, so actually about 16 seconds. So don't worry, it will appear. Once the slides are up, you can synchronize the slides with either your phone or the webcast audio by clicking the button at the bottom of the slideshow. Mute your computer if you're listening via phone so you don't get an echo. We have an hour and a half for tonight's webinar, so without further ado, let me introduce our speaker. Dr. Fader specializes in neurobehavioral medicine. He applies DIR, floor time, with families and in schools. He does research, teaches, consults, and hosts support groups for professionals and families. Dr. Fader sits on the bridge, which stands for Bond, Regulate, Interact, Develop, Guide, and Engage Collaborative, a community-wide effort for early identification and intervention in the San Diego County. He serves as Medical Education Director for the Rady Children's Hospital Autism Research Workgroup and has served on the Autism Committee and on the Medications and Autism Panel of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. Dr. Fader reviews grants for the Organization for Autism Research and the National Foundation for Autism Research and is a commentator on Valerie's List, a web-based information service for autism and related disorders. Welcome, Dr. Fader.
Thanks so much for that introduction. It's great to be back. I did a similar webinar about a year ago on symbolic thinking that was just delightful. And I'm really glad to be back. If you see the slides, you'll see that I will be posting these slides or something similar to them on circlestretch.com. You can also see on this slide that you can contact me if you have some questions at my email, jdfeder@pol.net. It will give you a bounce back saying that if this is an emergency, contact your doctor, or words to that effect, and let you know that it takes me a few days to get back to people. But I'm pretty obsessive about getting back to you, so if you have a question you want to email me, you're welcome to do so. As we were saying, I'm an assistant. Well, I don't know if we went through my whole CV, but I'm an clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UCSD School of Medicine, and I'm also the director of research in the Graduate School for the Interdisciplinary Council on Developmental and Learning Disorders. That's the Greenspan, Weider, Floor Time people. So we have a grad school where we have about 70 students learning early intervention and infant mental health, and I teach biostatistics, and I'm doing a medication class coming up, and we do some research as well supporting that. So among my various things that I do. My disclosures include for the ICDL grad school, they pay me to teach and to be the director of research and to review clinical write-ups and give me room and board for travel and meetings. I also work for NIMH and Duke University doing some administrative time for pharmacogenetic research. I may refer to that a little bit later in this talk so that you understand what that work is all about. And then finally, for the Bridge Collaborative that we'd already mentioned, I used to get a token honorarium for ongoing consultation. We reduced that to nothing until we're waiting for the next grant to come in. But it is important in medicine these days to tell people where your money comes from and where that helps people understand conflicts of interest. So I guess you would call it a conflict of interest. In this slide, I want to talk for a moment about DIR, which is the Developmental Individual Differences Relationship-Based Approach to Understanding Developmental Learning Disorders, including Autism Spectrum Disorders, and plenty of other things. The reason why I like this method is that, very much like my medical training, which was holistic biopsychosocial training, it's broad. It thinks about the whole child, supports the family. It's very welcoming. The approach is all about building love between people, usually parents and their kids, to help support development and better function. And it's very enriching. The idea is that this closeness can bring real progress. So when I think about using medications, what I'm really thinking about is the entire picture. So DIR, in a nutshell, has these developmental levels, functional, emotional, developmental levels, that first talk about having someone be regulated enough to be able to engage in an interaction, and then having this kind of engagement, warm, trusting relationship with somebody, or building moments of that into more of a relationship. And then finally, a flow of enriching interactions. And that might start from something very simple as back and forth cueing or playing with something to much, much richer kinds of abstract thinking at the very highest levels of this kind of function. So, and it's all about social problem solving, where you are, what you're doing, because the brain is a social organ, as Dan Siegel likes to say, and we all live in a social context. So that's the developmental piece. The individual differences part means understanding what it is about a person that enables them to be able to relate and engage. So we think about sensory processing, motor tone and motor planning, receptive and expressive communication, and by that I mean not just language, but also nonverbal cueing, or all the different things we do that can communicate to each other, even if they're not always words, but words count, of course, as well. Visual spatial functioning, so your ability to use vision to understand where you are in the world, and one of the reasons I kind of split that out, or I should say ICDL, DIR splits that out, is because so much of your brain is devoted to in a typical person devoted to visual spatial function, that it's worth having as a separate category to think about. And cognitive functioning, so the ability to have an idea, make a plan about what you're going to do about that idea, have a sequence of steps of what you're going to do to carry out that idea, then executing those steps, and finally, because nothing ever happens the way we expect, adapting to circumstances. So as a quick example for this webinar, the email came in saying, Dr. Fader, we want you on the phone 15 minutes beforehand to make sure there are no glitches. I emailed back and said, I'm sorry, I won't be able to be available until just a minute or two before. And it worked out okay, thank goodness. The last piece of the DIR model that we think about is that it's relationship-based. Again, it's all about connecting, making time with other people to support them and to help them. So you might have a caregiver helping a child, a therapist helping the caregiver, and a tutor or some support network helping the therapist. Everybody's kind of in a chain of supporting each other within the context of a relationship, so that we're always thinking about what works and what could work better. So that's kind of the broad perspective in which maybe medications might be helpful. The handout will be posted on circlestretch.com. Actually, this or a similar handout will be on Circle Stretch. I know there's one right now. This is our local San Diego community website that talks about the things that I do and also about a lot of other ICDL stuff, including school programs, things like that. And actually, a circle stretch card is on this slide. It's, you know, if you need DIR in a nutshell, just help the person be calm enough to interact, truly connected to others, and in a continuous, expanding, balanced, back-and-forth flow of interaction. So the byline is, go for that gleam in the eye. So that you can just print that and put that in your pocket and take it around and try it out and let me know how it goes. But this talk, or if you find under my talks, under Dr. Fader Medication Talk, it'll be there. So it's there for you. Let me give you a very quick history of medications in autism. In 1989, a woman named Dr. Magda Campbell was at Bellevue in New York, and she found that the medication haloperidol helped people with pretty severe autism who were at Bellevue, inpatients at Bellevue, little kids, in social learning. Other people in that epoch of the late 80s and early 90s were finding that methylphenidate, the stuff that we use, you would call it Ritalin usually, we use for ADHD, seemed to cause side effects in people with autism but didn't give them much benefit. So there's just a little bit of information, and it's actually fairly recent. 1989, in my mind, isn't all that long ago. Haloperidol, by the way, is a cousin and forerunner of the medications that we'll talk about in a second that have been approved for use in people with autism, Abilify and Risperdal. But before that part of the story, from the 1990s through about 2006, really we were doing what child psychiatrists pretty much always do. We treated target symptoms based on responses in other conditions to medication. So there is a lot of use of what we call the neuroleptics, the antipsychotics, for aggression and self-injurious behavior, or, for instance, using medicines like Ritalin that is used for ADHD to try to help the overactive and impulsive symptoms in autism as well, things like that. Well, come about 2004, you probably, if you were around, heard about this, there was a black box warning for the use of SSRIs, that's kind of the Prozac family of medicines, in kids, saying that there is this risk that it might create suicidal thoughts or ideation. And that actually led to a huge drop in the number of SSRI prescriptions in kids. And instead of helping with suicidality in kids, the suicide rate went way up. It had been dropping while doctors were giving SSRIs right and left to kids who seemed depressed. And it went up again when those prescriptions went down. So the hypothesis is that, although I'm sure it's true because I've seen it, that sometimes when people get an SSRI, they do have some suicidal thoughts. It's not a good thing. Well, for one thing, there's never been like a proven case that the medicine caused a suicide. But worse, the entire population, when you're not treating depression, more likely people do hurt themselves, which is sad. How does that relate to autism? Well, when you have a black box warning, nobody wants to use those medications very much. And in autism, it's even more controversial. We'll get to that a little bit later, so you'll have to stand by. In 2006, Risperidone, was approved by the FDA for marketing for use in autism for irritability. Now, I'll talk a little bit more about this class of medicines later, but that was a big deal. These are medicines that have been used anyway, but Janssen Pharmaceuticals finally figured out that this was quite a community to sell medication to and went to the trouble of doing enough tests to show that there is reduced irritability, and there's been a lot of marketing since then, so it's kind of about the marketing. Early in 2009, there was a study showing Celexa, one of the SSRIs, wasn't working very well for obsessive-compulsive disorder in autism spectrum disorders, and that becomes interesting, too, as you'll see in the Cochrane report. And then in late 2009, Abilify was approved, a cousin to Risperdal in some ways, for irritability in autism. That Cochrane report that came out at the end of 2010 was basically saying that serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitors, like, as I said, Prozac, Paxil, Celexa, Lexapro, Luvox, fluvoxamine, and sertraline, Zoloft, might not be very good for people with autism, and you mostly had side effects. So that's kind of the quick history of medications in autism. We're going to go into all of these a little bit more later on. really the story today has to do with the term evidence-based medicine or evidence-based practice. You're probably hearing about this when people are fighting for such things as insurance to cover ABA or DIR or similar kinds of interventions. Everyone says, well, you know, what is an evidence-based practice, evidence-based treatment? Well, this gentleman named Dr. Sackett in the British Medical Journal in 1996 gave us a really nice definition of what evidence-based medicine ought to be. He calls it the conscientious, explicit, and judicious use of current best evidence in making decisions about the care of patients. And it's kind of a tricky combination. What it means is that we need the current best evidence of something, so research that helps us understand what we're doing, otherwise your practice is out of date, but we also need to be using clinical expertise and judgment, or even excellent external evidence might be inapplicable or inappropriate for an individual patient. So, for example, if you have evidence that a particular procedure will teach your child to name all the colors of the rainbow, well, that seems to be a pretty good thing. But if that's what you're doing for all children and maybe some child doesn't really respond to it and you just keep doing it over and over again, I think people talk about the definition of insanity is doing something over and over again when you're not getting anywhere. Well, it sort of teaches you that maybe you should stop doing it. But sometimes people get a little bit waylaid and keep doing things over and over anyway, despite the expertise, experience, judgment that it's not working very well. So you've got to combine best evidence, clinical experience, and family culture and values to really decide what's going to be best. And really, the people who should decide are parents and families. So evidence-based practice, I don't know if there's a slide on it here. No, I didn't do that. But if you look in, you know, some of my other ones, I'm going to go back to this one. You'll see a Venn diagram where you've got three bubbles. One bubble is best evidence. The other bubble, the next bubble is clinical expertise and judgment. And the third bubble is family culture and values. Because really, it's the family who really has to figure out what's going to be a good fit for them, based on our telling you, doctors and therapists, giving you the idea of what we have evidence for and what has worked in our experience. So I know that's sort of a long introduction, but it's important because, especially when you're talking about medication, we don't have a lot of evidence. What we have is some clinical expertise, and then we have your values as a family about what you want to do and why you might want to do it. So when you're talking about medication and trying to figure out what to do, what doctors are supposed to do is they're supposed to go through a process called informed consent. And formally, there's a lot of pieces to that. Informally, a lot of times when you go in and get a pill, they don't go through this, or you don't even sign a paper. I have my patient sign a paper, and we see this as an ongoing process where you're thinking about these things all the time. So one thing is the diagnosis, and that's helpful, but because most people, even with autism, come in with pieces of eight different diagnoses or whatever, a lot of different diagnoses, that doesn't necessarily tell you precisely what to do. And even if you did have a very precise diagnosis, let's say classic DSM-4-TR autism, you wouldn't have, you know, and you've got some target symptoms of obsessionality or overactivity, we don't have the studies that'll tell you just what to do. So diagnosis is important, but it certainly doesn't tell you what to do. Target symptoms are really important. I like to list, and I'll show you how I grid out all the target symptoms that are going on, and then we kind of prioritize those because that's what you're going to try to go after in a way that helps you move the rest of the plan forward. The treatment protocol means how you're going to go about doing this, and most of the time, you give one medicine at a time. You don't give two or three different ones. Or I should say it's probably best not to give two or three different ones because then you don't know what's helping or what's hurting. You try not to make big changes at once or dramatic changes unless perhaps there's some sort of emergency. You try to do things in as close to a scientific way as possible. Try to not have too many variables if you can. talk about alternative treatments, so that means different medications that you might be using for the same target symptoms, but also other treatments, including, for instance, if you're trying to help someone regulate better, well, you might want to use a medication, but you might also want to think about sensory integration, occupational therapy, or you might want to back up and just see if there's something else that is dysregulating the person. For instance, you know, maybe one of the parents is depressed and irritable, and having the parent have some support or treatment might make the whole thing better. We also like to talk about the results of not treating. Okay, if we don't do anything, usually the answer is nothing changes, but it's important just to state the obvious so that people kind of have it all in context. Side effects are important. We're going to talk about some side effects of various medications. And then there's FDA labeling. So the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, allows pharmaceutical companies to market their products for specific diagnoses and specific symptoms in those diagnoses. So for Risperdal and Abilify, the FDA has approved marketing by the companies that produce those medications for autism, for irritability, the symptom of irritability, so kind of, you know, edginess, irritability in autism, and for nothing else. And there is no other FDA approval for marketing of any medication for any other reason than autism. So everything else that you do is considered experimental. Doctors have the authority to use any medication for any reason they want. That's part of the fun of being a doctor and also part of the responsibility. If you're going to do that, you ought to have a good rationale and you ought to be careful. But most of what we do is officially considered experimental. So you say, why would I want anybody experimenting on my child? And the answer to that is, you really want to think about it before you do something like that. I'm here to talk about medications, but as my grandmother always said, try to be the surgeon who knows when not to cut, meaning to me, try to be the psychiatrist who knows when not to give a medication, or just be pretty darn careful about it when you do. I take my grandmother's words to heart. Consent and assent. Well, consent means if you're the parent and you have a child, or you're the parent of an adult child who isn't able to make their own decisions, you're the person who makes that decision. You give consent, usually based on lots of information. Sometimes someone who doesn't have the ability to make the decision will go along with it. We call that assent. And in kids, developmentally, there are different levels of assent. Sometimes they understand something about the medication. Sometimes they don't. But as people become more and more aware, it's usually helpful to have them partner with us in thinking about the medication, what helps and what doesn't help. So then I have in my informed consent sheet, I talk about comments, questions, and concerns. And usually what I mean by that is we're going to track this closely. You know, I want to see what's going on. I want you to stay in touch with me. I want to know if you're having trouble. Now, most of the time, there's some sort of trouble. Just like when we were talking about cognition in the DIR model, no plan as you execute it goes the way you expected, so you have to kind of come back and adapt your plan. So we really want to track things closely, stay in touch, and as we move forward. Since we have to live with all this uncertainty, we really have to have good working relationships with our doctors. It's important that you find a doctor you like and you can work with. Try to keep the doctor in the loop. The doctor really has to have some data and shouldn't be working in kind of a black box where you walk in for 10 minutes, you say it's better, it's not better. I mean, it'd be nice to have something from teachers or therapists, maybe an email, maybe a quick something that says, yeah, we're on track, or, you know, this particular piece isn't going so well. But you also have to be careful not to overwhelm your doctor with data. If you walk in and say, you know, I'd like you to read this book, because that will explain my child, they might not do it. Now, I like to do that, but not all my colleagues can, so I'm not going to speak for all my colleagues. You should expect them, however, to be interested in opinions from other doctors. You should expect them to be interested in some data from the outside. The other thing I want to remind you is that while in the autism world we always talk about the term biomedical, by which we usually mean things like hyperbaric oxygen or different kinds of uses of even regular medications like antifungals, antivirals, because of theories that have to do with autism and its etiology and maybe treatment, that term confuses doctors. They think you're talking about regular medicine, whereas what you're really talking about is alternative or complementary medicine from their standpoint. So if you could just explain that to them and also tell them everything else you're doing, it's important. In fact, sometimes some of the things that we do on the side may be quite harmful when mixed with the things that your doctor is doing. And so they probably need to look up for drug-drug interactions if you're giving herbals, this or that. And I'll talk a little bit more about that, particularly when we talk about SSRIs. Why do people use medications? Usually because we're stuck. You know, most people consider medicines when they're desperate, or maybe in emergencies, such as if someone's very aggressive or very depressed, maybe some other kinds of emergencies as well. Self-injurious behavior is a good example. Or perhaps just because there's lack of progress. You feel like you got a pretty good plan going, but nothing's moving, and you feel like, okay, well, you know, maybe we need to try some medicine to see if we can move this along. What kind of progress is important? That gets to the question of what do you want for your child. To me, when it gets right down to it, what I usually find with most families is for their child they want a meaningful life, socially, emotionally, maybe cognitively, but that requires a real plan, and medication alone is never a plan. What happens usually when you start medication is that people get all about the medication, they forget about everything else going on. So if something's going wrong, it's like, okay, well, what happened with the medication? Let's change the medication. Plenty of times during the day, my answer to a problem is, okay, well, maybe we don't need to change the medication. Maybe we need to take some time and understand this a little bit better, make a few phone calls, talk to some people, try to unpack this and figure out what's going on. The central question to me then is, are you trying to improve an appropriate plan or situation, or are you trying to use medication to make up for what is an inadequate or bad plan? Not enough supervision on the bus, the child is going out of control, they come to you and say, doctor, give me a medication so my child's in control on the bus. I'm saying, well, maybe what we need is supervision, not medication. That's expensive in one way or another, but you know, you have to try to be thoughtful and advocate for a plan that's really going to make sense, not try to paper things over with a pill. Other issues, people wonder whether medications will change your child's brain and fix it. The answer to that is, I think so sometimes. Another question is, can medications injure my child? And I think the answer to that is, I think so sometimes. And then the last question is often, what should I expect? And the answer to that is, I really don't know, but I'll walk with you on the path and we'll see what happens. We'll talk more about fixing brains and injuring brains as we talk about these medications. Other common reasons to consider medications: to avoid losing time while pulling a program together. We all know that it can take years to pull a good program together. Well, okay, so you want to maybe try to do as much as you can while you're trying to do that. You don't want to miss out on a chance of something that might be helpful. That's understandable. It's messy, but hey, this is a messy field. These are messy situations. I get it. Then there's the question about awakening. Sometimes people are trying for a miracle. Back in the 1990s at Yale, there were, you know, a number of experiences using the precursors to Abilify, in fact, using Risperdal, which was sort of a precursor in some ways to Abilify, and finding that some kids really did a whole lot better. And so it makes you think, well, gee, I don't want to withhold that from, you know, any child because, you know, maybe we should try it out because you might get a miracle. And the truth is, occasionally, some people do a lot better. My personal feeling in retrospect is that there probably aren't a whole lot of miracles in autism caused by these medications, neuroleptic class like Risperdal and Abilify and the other cousins like Zyprexa. What I think may be going on is we probably have a subset of people who have a psychotic illness that is also interfering, and the medicine makes that better. And so it feels like a miracle, but it's maybe a good thing, but it's not exactly fixing the autism as much as maybe fixing something else that's concurrent to autism. So it's very confusing. You know, back in the day, we thought autism was 4 in 10,000. Now we're thinking 1 in 110, in the military, 1 in 88 kids. Well, psychotic illness is about 1 in 100. So if you have 100 kids with autism, maybe you'll have one of those kids with autism who has a psychotic illness. And they may respond really well to an antipsychotic medication. Hopefully that makes sense. So then when one person responds, people hear about that and they all want to try it too, like for a lot of things that we try with our kids. The bottom line is that medication probably does not treat core symptoms, but it might make some target symptoms and co-occurring conditions like depression or psychosis better and give the person, the child, the adult, more affective availability, more emotional ability so that we can make progress in the overall plan. And that's all if you can avoid significant side effects. So as I mentioned earlier, I like to grid out these target symptoms and then prioritize them, and then I'll talk a little bit more about core symptoms too before we get into that. So when we talk about core symptoms of autism, we're often talking about problems with language function, socialization, and restricted range of interests. That's according to DSM, and then you've got the ancillary symptoms according to DSM, sensory problems, motor problems, stuff like that. I think most of us think about it all as part of the syndrome and not so much ancillary. But the way that I think medication may help would be by supporting regulation and our ability to help someone be regulated, co-regulation, by treating, for example, impulsivity, inattention, anxiety, and maybe making rigid thinking or perseveration a little bit better. So that's one way. Another thing that we might be able to do, a lot of our kids are very sensitive to emotion. And so if we can help them be a little bit more tolerant and more less likely to become overwhelmed, well, then maybe we have more of a chance of working with them. So sometimes medication can do that. And you'll see when we kind of look at this grid what that looks like. Again, as I said above, treating co-occurring conditions like depression can certainly help because depression really gets in the way of helping someone move forward. They're not thinking in a positive way. They don't feel good about themselves. And that doesn't have to be a verbal thing. That can be a nonverbal thing. And they might promote abstract reasoning and thinking. So getting back to those neuroleptic medications, another use for them is sometimes promoting that sort of function. So here's the grid. Now, I've listed, you know, a bunch of typical symptoms up at the top that people talk about with autism. I certainly haven't listed everything, but I've got activity, meaning overactivity, attention, meaning inattention, anxiety, you can see this is alphabetical, cognition, depression, mood instability or aggression, or even self-injurious behavior I kind of lumped together, motor planning, obsessive compulsive, that's what OC is, rigidity or perseverative kinds of thinking, so thinking and doing things over and over, reciprocal interaction, meaning that ability to have a back and forth kind of interaction, sensory sensitivity, tics, motor tics, sleep problems, ooh, that was out of order in terms of alphabeticness, ooh, not good, and then et cetera, right? There's always other things that we think about. On the column going down, I listed some of the main classes of medications that we'll talk about and that are often used, stimulants, SSRIs, those are the Prozac family, neuroleptics, that's the Risperdal Abilify family, AEDs, anti-epileptic drugs, and we'll talk about those, steroids, which are sometimes used particularly when people are young and regressing, and we catch it in time, and central alpha agonists, so we'll talk about those as well. And there's many other treatments, and when I'm making this list for families, I'm listing the non-medication treatments as well. So we're talking about support to the teacher, occupational therapy, speech and language, and communication therapies, other kinds of things that might be helpful for these, and figuring out what's best. At the very right-hand column, you'll see that I have some comments, and for me that's a reminder, for instance, with stimulants to talk about weight, height, and that reminds me to talk about blood pressure and pulse, and also tics, because sometimes you can have tics kind of come out a little bit with stimulants. SSRIs, I think about weight, height, seizure risk. For neuroleptics, I think about weight, seizure risk, and we'll talk about tardive dyskinesia, neuroleptic malignant syndrome. That's what NMS stands for, TD. For the AEDs, there's multiple side effects. For the steroids, there's multiple side effects. For central alpha agonists, I think about sleep and blood pressure. So the idea of that is that we've got really three things we're dealing with. The symptoms, the target symptoms, and prioritizing those, the treatments that we might try, but also the caveat that these things have side effects are things we have to watch and think about. So we're going to talk now about specific psychotropic medications. It's important to try to always know the brand and the generic names of medications. They often don't correspond or they sound like other things, and you have to really pay attention to the detail of the spelling if you can. So I hate to say it, but sometimes these things are really, really important because there can be mix-ups at pharmacies or just going to another doctor and saying, oh, I think he's on Zyrtec when it was actually Zyprexa that you were on. Very different medications, one's for a head cold, the other one's for psychosis, et cetera, et cetera. RxList.com is one of my favorite websites. I'll Google that up even during an appointment sometimes because they have a lot of the information from the physician's desk reference listed in a very accessible manner, including what the medication is, what the FDA-approved uses are, what the dosage forms are, what the typical side effects are, et cetera, et cetera. It's not going to be comprehensive telling you about a medication, but it's a good place to get a start. So the following list that we'll go through and the information is not going to be comprehensive. And you know, as we always say, please talk with your own healthcare provider for further information. So I'm not here to give you medical advice for your child, but to give you an idea about these medications and maybe the good questions to ask about them. Let's start talking with stimulants. Stimulants are the medicines that we typically use for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. They're often the medications that are first used with people on the autism spectrum because, especially when people are little, the symptoms that first crop up, even before a diagnosis of autism oftentimes, are symptoms of impulsivity and inattention. And so because of that, sometimes people will start treating with stimulants before anything else. Well, methylphenidate and dextroamphetamine are the two main stimulants used in the United States for ADHD, and they have various trade names, including Ritalin, Concerta, Metadate, Methylin, and Focalin for methylphenidate, and Adderall or dextroamphetamine mixed salts for dextroamphetamine, and more recently, Vyvanse for dextroamphetamine. The two main medicines, methylphenidate and dextroamphetamine, have slightly different mechanisms of action that I'm not going to get into, but they have similar possible side effects, including reduced appetite, disruption of sleep, a withdrawal syndrome where when you're coming down off the medication, you feel depressed and very irritable, but it can also be associated with just creating a depression and creating unstable mood. Both can bring out tics. Both can bring out a more obsessive or perseverative kind of thinking or behavior, and et cetera means there's plenty more. There's also the risk of drug diversion. Because these medicines have a street value, sometimes people will start selling them, which is not a good thing. The other is the question of whether giving someone stimulant medications could create a risk for drug abuse, because these are similar to things like methamphetamine and cocaine in some fashion. The truth about that in ADHD anyway is that people with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder do have a higher risk of drug abuse. They tend to act impulsively and self-medicate, but when you treat them successfully with these medications, many studies have shown that they're less likely to make bad choices and their drug abuse risk is actually less. The other thing to think about is the question of ADHD and autism spectrum disorder. Now, these are very different disorders. On the other hand, almost everybody with an attention deficit disorder doesn't have autism. But almost everybody with an autism spectrum disorder has symptoms of inattention or impulsivity or hyperactivity. So it makes you think, is there a link between the two? And in fact, there have been a couple of genetic linkage studies showing that there is some overlap between the two conditions. So when we think about treating autism spectrum disorders with stimulants, there's some biological genetic rationale for giving it a try. Doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work, because the side effects are more likely to occur with people with autism spectrum disorders. Or really, for anybody with an ASD, any medication you use is more likely to get side effects, if only because these are complex disorders affecting interconnectivity throughout the brain, and all kinds of other deficits. And so it's not so simple as the disorders for which these medications are usually used. And so you almost have to expect more problems cropping up. All that said, stimulants sometimes make a good plan workable. And I'm going to go back to that gridding symptoms slide just to kind of show you a little bit about that. If you look at the part that says stimulants and you look at the things that it might help with, well, you see a lot of question marks and pluses and minuses and minuses. But I just want to call your attention to the part that says activity, attention, cognition, motor planning, and reciprocal interaction. It sometimes happens that stimulant medications do settle people down enough so that they are able to learn better, they're less active, they pay better attention, think better, they're able to get through their math problems and things like that. Motor plan, they're better able to participate in activities with their peers and other kids, typical and other people with challenges, and oftentimes they're more able to engage in reciprocal interaction. That's huge if that can happen. Now, it doesn't always happen because you have side effects, this, that, and the other thing, but it can make a good plan workable. Not going to make up for a bad plan if you give a medication that helps someone engage better, but nobody's engaging with the person. Well, that hasn't really helped you very much. But if you're trying to engage with someone and you give them a medication that helps them do that, you're way ahead of the game. So I like stimulants for that reason, and I often prescribe them carefully, very carefully. SSRIs. So that gets back to the Cochrane report. SSRIs are just one of many classes of antidepressants. I'm not going to talk a whole lot about other antidepressants. You'll see I have a few comments about them, but they're the ones you've heard about the most. They were first developed, Prozac was the first one released in the U.S. in about 1989, and they replaced more dangerous tricyclic medications that, while they were very effective for depression, were cardiotoxic, so that if someone was depressed and had a suicidal moment and ate all their medicine, it was a very dangerous thing. SSRIs, the joke back then was that you couldn't afford enough to hurt yourself, partly because they were expensive, but really partly because they were much, much, much safer. The Cochrane Report in 2010 basically said, look, these medicines, we can't really prove that they help people with autism, but we can certainly prove that they cause a number of side effects. And the chief side effect that we worry about, you'll see further down on the slide, is something we call behavioral activation. That really mimics ADHD, impulsive, inattentive, can't think very well. So guess what often happens? Someone is using an SSRI maybe to help someone try to be a little bit less perseverative, because these medicines, you know, may help depressed mood, may help anxiety. We think sometimes maybe they help obsessiveness, although that's less likely. So let's say we're using the medication, but then the person starts becoming very activated. Well, then somebody might want to give them an ADHD medicine, a stimulant, to try to settle them down. But then the ADHD medicine might make the person more obsessive and perseverative, or even depressed. So then we add more SSRI, and you can kind of see you end up in a round robin. And it can start at either the SSRI point, or it can start with the stimulant in the first place. You give them the stimulant for overactivity, they get a little depressed. You give them Prozac or Zoloft or one of these others, and maybe they're a little less depressed, but then they're more activated, and then you give them more stimulant. So it's very common that this occurs, which is why I mentioned it. But lots of times you can balance these things out so that they work okay. It's just you have to have good communication with your doctor. You have to have data coming in. You have to do these things in a thoughtful way. They really, really can help depressed mood. I have to tell you that I've had a number of cases of people on the spectrum, oftentimes high-functioning enough to be able to talk about it, who are feeling depressed and suicidal, and perhaps because they realize that the world really is a pretty tough place for them. And SSRIs have helped a number of those people be a little bit less depressed, enough so that we can work with it. Getting rid of the depression, I'm not so sure. In some cases, I think it really does get rid of it. In enough cases, it seems to knock out the suicidality, meaning no longer suicidal. I'm happy with that because I get very, very frightened when anybody's suicidal, even if we think they're just crying for help, it's nevertheless a risk that they'll do something. And with people on the spectrum, because sometimes they're very narrow in their thinking and very good at carrying out a narrow plan, I worry about suicide risk a little bit more. So besides the behavioral activation side effect, some people get some weight gain, some people get some weight loss. A recent paper said it's kind of a wash in a large population, but definitely some people have carbohydrate cravings and get a little tubby. Other people get some diarrhea or looser stools and lose some weight. It's hard to know what's going to happen ahead of time. You can also get mood instability. With any antidepressant, it could destabilize your mood or even make you manic, meaning your mood is elevated, you feel like you're on top of the world, maybe king or queen of the world, and that's not so good, and you have to reduce the medicine or combine it with something else, and it gets very complicated. The other thing these medicines do is they do lower seizure threshold, and as you may know, in our kids with autism and autism-related disorders, seizures are more common, particularly the more challenged a person is, and also in early childhood and in adolescence, there are spikes of more likelihood of seizures, apparently. And so these medicines, especially used in high doses, might be associated with the onset of seizures, and I've seen it happen a couple times in my career. And I've been doing this for decades now, so it's only been a couple times, but you know, it makes you think twice. I had already mentioned that black box warning about suicidal thinking and lower rates of actual suicide in the populations treated with SSRIs, so I'm not going to belabor it. What I will say is that, for me, I used to be happier with these medications than I am currently. But I'll tell you, if somebody is very depressed, I definitely would consider them, maybe for anxiety. Less likely, I'm less excited about using them for obsessiveness. I'll just go back. You know, I was going to talk about neuroleptics, but I just want to point out on that grid slide, slide number 21, that if you look at stimulants and then below it you look at SSRIs, you can see the negative numbers for activity and inattention that sort of parallel the positive slash negative signs for stimulants. And then on anxiety, SSRIs might help, maybe not, and stimulants might make anxiety worse. What's another good one? For obsessionality, you know, two-thirds across to the right, SSRIs might help that, but stimulants might make it worse. So you see this sort of parallel between the two, or opposite parallel. So I'm going to move on to neuroleptics. And again, those are the Risperdal and Abilify, and I list Zyprexa first probably because I use a lot of it, Seroquel, Geodan, Haldol, Melaril, Thorazine's the mother of them all. Actually, Thorazine was discovered while looking for new cold medications, and it turned out that when they were testing this medicine back in, I think, the 1950s, they were testing it on populations of psychiatric patients who had hallucinations, and not only did their colds get better, but their hallucinations got better too. And so a whole new class of medication was born. They do typically help with aggression. They do typically help with mood stability. And yes, we've talked about the occasional question of miracles where, you know, I think they might be just treating psychotic symptoms that were already there, not necessarily the autism. And they also help with classic tics and tic disorders. They help as adjuncts for depression. You've probably seen Seroquel in particular, and I guess Abilify, a number of them are marketed now for helping antidepressants work better. And I find that in my regular clinical psychiatric practice, my practice is divided about halfway between people on the spectrum or with other developmental disorders and other people who have depression, bipolar, stuff like that. And for people with severe depression, lots of times this helps that antidepressant work better. They seem to help a lot of people with perseverative, obsessive kinds of thinking. So whereas the SSRIs, which are fabulous for OCD in a typical person, neurotypical person, don't work very well in autism, these medicines seem to help it a little bit better. I don't know exactly why that is, although I do have my theories, and I'll get to that a little bit later. The side effects are the problem here. You know, this is major chemotherapy for the brain. Oftentimes, people gain a whole lot of weight, which is a big problem. Their lipid levels are messed up, but they can have sugar issues, meaning some insulin resistance that looks a little bit like adult-onset diabetes, not a good thing. And they, too, lower seizure thresholds, so you could be in for more seizure problems. You have to be careful about that. You can get a fever and muscle stiffness. That's that neuroleptic malignant syndrome, NMS, that I mentioned earlier. That is extremely dangerous, and people ought to be telling you if you're on these medicines that that's a risk. It's not common. Well, some people say a very mild form of it happens in 10%, which would be very common, but the very severe forms, I'm not sure exactly how rare they are because they're so rare. But if you're on this medicine at any time and you become very stiff and hot, that's a medical emergency, and you need to go to the ER and you need to tell the doctors, you know, what medicines you are. They'll probably give you fluids and, well, or your child fluids, and maybe certain medications, or even use electroconvulsive therapy to reverse it. Very, very scary. Very, very rare. Very, very scary. The other thing that you need to watch for are new abnormal movements. They're not tics. They don't quite look like that. They look more typically like rabbity movements of your mouth. With Easter coming, you remember rabbits, right? They kind of make up as they're eating their carrots. When people start doing that, that might be a sign of tardive dyskinesia. Actually, about a quarter of us will probably get that if we live to be elderly. If you go to a nursing home, that's not always people's teeth that they're making rabbity faces about. That may be tardive dyskinesia. Now, it can also be kind of wiggly movements in the rest of your body, and that can be pretty disfiguring. And the truth of a few years ago, I'm not sure it's still true, was that when psychiatrists got sued, usually it was either because somebody killed themselves, heaven forbid, or because they got tardive dyskinesia and nobody warned them about that that might happen, because it can be disfiguring and it can be permanent. So what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to screen people about every 6 months using something like an abnormal involuntary movement scale, and I actually put a copy of that at the end of these slides so that you can see what that looks like. And doctors, it's not that hard for them to do and to ask you about those kinds of things so we can look at it. And if we wonder about it, then we can get a movement specialist to look at it as well. Another risk that we need to think about with neuroleptics is stroke, particularly in elderly people. You may have heard of these medicines being used in our elderly parents for sundowning when they get very confused or delirious at the end of the day. And while these medicines don't necessarily work better than other medicines, they do have a bit of a stroke risk. And then there's the question of cardiac problems, particularly with Giodan, but I like to get an EKG on anybody with these medicines because if there's something abnormal, I wonder whether that it might create a risk. Some people ask whether we should always consider neuroleptics, and that harks back to this whole miracle thing. It also, and I'm going to go back to the gridding slide again, my favorite slide. It's also because if you look at the target symptoms at the top and you look at what neuroleptics might do, you can see that it might help just about everything. So you almost wonder, well, why don't we try everybody on a little bit of neuroleptic? Of course, the reason is all the side effects. The anti-epileptic drugs, a.k.a. anti-seizure medications, well, there's just so many of them, and they're so different that it's hard to talk about them really as a group. They're all for seizures, and most of them help, well, many of them help for mood stabilization, and that's what we end up using them for typically in people with autism and related disorders. They might also help other medications work better. So sometimes someone is on a stimulant and it's not working very well, but you put them on, an anticonvulsant, and it works better. Same thing with antidepressants. As we talked about with the neuroleptics, helping an antidepressant work better. Sometimes the anti-epileptic drugs help them work better as well. That brings us to the idea of combined pharmacology versus a polypharmacy. Polypharmacy is when a doctor or doctors keep throwing a new medication at somebody in an effort to chase a side effect, like the I was talking about the SSRI and stimulant chasing each other, trying to make something better, or even adding yet another medicine, a mood-stabilizing neuroleptic because now mood's out of, just adding and adding without thinking. Polypharmacy is a problem. When someone comes in on more than one medication, you can bet that we don't have any research on the combination. Now, certainly many of us, including me, will use more than one medication, 2, 3, 4, maybe more. We don't like to do that. We would rather be thinking about these things in what we call combined pharmacotherapy instead, meaning you've thought about it, you're not just chasing one side effect of another medication, you're trying to minimize medications when you can, you're being careful. So the reason that comes up with anti-epileptic drugs is their history is replete with instances where people use a lot of medications to go after seizures or added a whole bunch to try to tamp down a bipolar disorder, something like that, and it got messy. Sudden, it says stopping, but it should say stopping, of these medications can also make seizures more likely. Kind of stands to reason that if you're giving anti-seizure medications, it's probably reducing seizure risk. If you suddenly stop them, you might get this rebound likelihood of seizure. In people who haven't had seizures, that might be less of a problem, but in people who have, and that's plenty of our kids, young and old, that could be a real issue. So you have to be careful about sudden stoppage of these medications. Specific anti-epileptic drugs worth mentioning, Depakote is one that's used pretty often. It's pretty reliable for mood stability. It's easy to load up. You have to watch blood levels. You have to watch platelets. Some people, platelets are what help keep you from bleeding initially, and if your platelets are low, you might bleed more easily. You might see bruising. You have to do liver tests. It's good to watch pancreatic enzymes, because sometimes you can get a pancreatitis. Carnitine levels are often important because sometimes when you're on Depakote, you use up a lot of your carnitine and you need supplemental carnitine. Otherwise, your ammonia level goes up, which isn't good for you. It's also associated with menstrual irregularities, and for that reason, I actually won't give Depakote to anybody who I think ever wants to give birth to a baby, because I think it affects ovarian function, or it's more so likely to affect ovarian function and maybe related to early polycystic ovary disease that I think it's a problem. But in a lot of our patients, that's not an issue, so maybe it's okay. People tend to gain weight. People can be sedated. And then finally, I wanted to mention that there are a lot of drug-drug interactions with medications. One of them with Depakote is with Lamictal, another anti-epileptic drug I'll mention. It's very hard to get them to work together without one making the other level spike up. And so with both of them, there are dangers in spiking levels. In Depakote, you can get a toxicity that makes you very jittery, and it's just really bad for you. With Lamictal, it can cause a rash that can be life-threatening, problematic. Tegretol, carbamazepine, a lot of people use it. I haven't found it reliable in my practice. I can never make this stuff work, and I've been using it for, again, a couple decades. You do have to watch blood levels, blood counts, because sometimes your blood counts can go down. You can become suddenly anemic, both your red cells and your white cells, opening you up for infection. You have to watch EKGs on that one. It's got many, many drug-drug interactions. People tend to gain weight. They can be sedated. And lots of times there's a very bad, bad rash. Trileptal, or oxycarbazine, is a cousin to Tegretol carbamazepine. And so it's been marketed as Tegretol light, meaning that it's less likely to have all these side effects. I see it having motor problems. A lot of people seem to be have less motor tone, and so they don't walk as well. They walk with a wide-based gait as if they're somewhat drunk, and that doesn't help our kids sometimes. Now, that said, I mean, with any of these medications, there are people who respond well to them. I just want you to know some of the side effects. It can have electrolyte issues, meaning you have to look at electrolytes, blood tests every once in a while. And it may, too, be associated with a very, very bad rash. I mean, there are drug rashes, but the rashes associated with Tegretol or Trileptal and Lamictal can be devastating. I think the reason why people feel like Trileptal is safer is that they just haven't used it as much as Tegretol, so there hasn't been a history built up of problems. That's often the case in medicine. That happened with a different medication, a weight loss medication called Meridia. You might have heard about 5 months ago, where it was finally taken off the market when people found after years of use that it didn't really help people lose weight very much, and it was associated with more cardiac deaths than it should have been. And so early on, you just didn't see that because these were rare events. But as time passed, there were more episodes, and I think that's probably going to be the case with Trileptal, oxycarbazine. We'll see over time. Keppra is easy to use. I'm not sure it works. Lamictal, as I mentioned before, is actually very good for mood stability. Some people think it also has antidepressant qualities. But you got to go really slow with this stuff because of the risk of a rash. Now, the rash is called Stevens-Johnson syndrome. And it's like, if you remember the toxic shock worries with tampons about 30 years ago, it's a very similar kind of rash where your skin kind of bubbles up in terrible blisters and falls off. And, you know, I'm talking about medications. I'm giving a good case not to use them. It's a very rare thing if you go up very slowly on the medication. And that's the problem. If you're looking for a quick answer, Lamictal is not your horse to pick. Topamax or topiramate is actually one that I like quite a bit because it's one of the few medications that we've got that seems to cause weight loss in a lot of people. So if you've got a medicine that is causing weight gain, like, I don't know, Risperdal, and you're trying to, A, reduce risk of seizure, and B, counterbalance some of the weight issue, and C, go after the mood stability a little bit better, you might think about using Topamax. The problem is that, well, it's not great for mood stabilization, but it might help. The other thing is that some people call Topamax Dopamax because it can make you a little dopey, meaning usually the loss of expressive communication. It's not as robust. So there's usually a point at which people aren't using their words as much, and that can be a problem with our kids. Usually you have to go pretty slow with this one, too. And if you do, sometimes you'll find that point more clearly and be able to back down a little bit and see if you think it's helpful or not. Plenty of people think it's helpful, and not only for mood stability, but for tics and for obsessionality. It's an interesting medicine. Neurontin or gabapentin is one that, to me, seems very benign. I don't think it does any harm, although there was one bad lawsuit about 15 years ago claiming that it did liver damage, sort of a famous case. The question really is whether it works at all. I think it really does help pain syndromes, and for some people, it really does seem to help mood stability. And again, if you went back to that gritting target symptoms slide, slide 21, what you'd see is all about, you know, mood stability. That's the only thing we see with these anti-epileptic drugs. Let me just go back to that for a second. So if you see that, really the thing that we're talking about is mood stability. Everything else, activity, attention, those things, yeah, maybe, but really that would be the reason you use this. So getting back to these anti-epileptic drugs, you might have heard of Lyrica or Pregabalin, which is used for pain and fibromyalgia and for partial seizures. Partial seizures aren't that uncommon in our kids, so it's something to think about. That's when you don't fall down and go unconscious, but you have maybe a motor movement that just happens sort of out of the blue, and it keeps happening over and over again out of the blue. Or Zerontin, ethosuximide, for partial seizures or for what we call absence seizures. Those are really common, too. That's when someone sort of goes out, not unconscious, but just very inattentive, and they're not answering to their name, for instance, for maybe 5, 10, 20 seconds, and then it kind of goes away, and the person is a little bit confused, but it's not like they ever went unconscious, like in a real seizure, or a real tonic-clonic, Grand mal seizure. And you can see on an EEG, you can kind of see these little 3-cycle-per-second runs of things that are associated with inattention. That happens in neurotypical people pretty often as well, but it also happens in our kids, and something worth knowing about. Zerontin does have some liver issues associated with it. In very, very young kids, it's a real problem, particularly preschoolers are very, very sensitive to medications. You've got to be careful with them, and particularly with anti-convulsive, anti-epileptic drugs. Steroids, I'll just spend a minute on. They used to be very popular for people who were regressing at a young age on the idea that they were similar to people with LKS, Landau-Kleffner syndrome. So the idea was that because some people with that syndrome, which is associated with a whole bunch of seizures and poor development, have responded to corticosteroid treatment, that maybe it would work in autism, and certainly there have been a few cases, reports, where it was helpful. And the theory is that there's some sort of inflammatory process going on. Steroids do help with cell membrane stabilization and inflammation. The problem with steroids is the side effects. The cushionoid is the term for this moon face with a hump on your back. Central obesity, meaning your belly gets big. Peripheral wasting means your arms and legs get sort of stick-like. Immune compromise, meaning you can get sick. more easily. Skin striations, kind of like stretch marks after pregnancy, can occur, and it can cause mood instability, including depression and hypomania. Really a problem. Lots of times this pulse dosing regimen is helpful, so giving the medicine every couple days or, you know, something like that seems to reduce some of those side effects. All that said, it's rare that you catch a child in the midst of what we call regression, and, you know, for the people who we catch that, I certainly refer them to a colleague of mine who likes to give it a try and follow closely with steroid treatment, but it's not one that ended up having quite as much utility as we thought it would. Central alpha agonists are probably the last class I'm going to spend a whole lot of time on. I want to leave some time to answer some of the questions. That's 10X, and Tuniv is the new version of that. Catapress is another central alpha agonist, otherwise known as clonidine. These medicines reduce fight, flight, sympathetic tone. You probably are aware that you've got an awake, alert, conscious central nervous system, and you also have an automatic called autonomic nervous system that runs things when you're not paying attention, things like your heart rate, your breathing, your gastrointestinal system, moving the muscles for digestion, things like that. Well, one end of that is the I just had a meal and I'm going to relax part called the parasympathetic nervous system, and it's balanced by that fight-flight system that kind of motors up when you're in a situation that's very problematic. And there's a great theory by an old mentor of mine, Steve Grossberg, out of Boston University, who talks about vigilance in people with autism. He's actually a mathematician who's done some really elegant work in looking at dynamic brain systems and how they function. But you'll get this analogy. If you're in the midst of bad traffic, heavy traffic, someone cuts you off, and suddenly all you could really think about is maybe flipping them the bird or saying choice words, then you're experiencing what happens when your internal vigilance is elevated and you're not thinking in a reflective and generous way. On the other hand, if you've foreseen that it might be bad traffic and you've decided that some people are in more of a hurry than you, you're listening to your favorite music so that you don't mind if it takes an extra hour to get home and someone cuts you off, you say, all right, he must be in a hurry, let him go, I'm not going to get into an accident, I'll just listen to my music. Well, that's when your vigilance is lower and you can think in a more reflective and abstract way. Well, these medications basically knock down that fight-flight sympathetic tone, allowing the parasympathetic tone to increase and giving you a better chance at being a little less vigilant and maybe thinking in a more reflective manner. In fact, a lot of the medicines do that, but the central alpha agonists probably a little bit more directly. Because these medicines were all developed for something else, which was high blood pressure, they can all cause dizziness because of low blood pressure. In kids, it's less of a problem. In adults, it's usually more of a problem. They're also somewhat sedating, and a lot of people will use clonidine in particular to get somebody to sleep. Unfortunately, most of the time, clonidine or catapress is so short-acting that you bounce awake after about 3 hours. 10X, guanfacine, and Intuniv, which is a much longer-acting version of guanfacine, will keep you asleep longer. If you're using a dose high enough to do that. But we use these during the day to try to reduce people's vigilance. Sometimes it helps with tics a little bit. There is this issue of early tolerance where you give a little bit of the medicine, it works for a few days, then you seem to have to go up a little bit because your body's adjusting. But that actually doesn't last. Your body can't keep adjusting to it, so you'll find a level that works. You just have to work with your doctor. The thing I really like about this medicine is that it's pretty mild. And again, going back to slide 21, the gridding thing, you remember the neuroleptics, you go across and everything could get better. With the central alpha agonist, it's the same story. Everything could get a little bit better. It's just milder. You might be a little sleepy. When you get a head cold, you get cranky. These medicines might make you cranky. So that's something to think about. In any case, I like them. I use them a lot. Worthy of your consideration. Intuniv is a much more expensive version of the others, which are cheap generics, and I used to be very cynical about it, but I actually have had a couple people respond to Intuniv when they didn't respond to the other versions, so maybe there is a real place for it. Maybe I don't have to be cynical that it's merely a repackaging to make money. Maybe it's got its place. Other commonly considered medications include Strattera, atomoxetine. It's a medicine that's marketed for ADHD, but is not a stimulant, so it has different side effects. So it's actually a failed antidepressant, so it has the side effects of antidepressants. The studies show, this is sort of a joke, it might be good as placebo, meaning if you give a nothing pill, you might feel better. Half the time people feel better with Strattera. Most studies show about half the time you might feel better with Strattera as well. Although, again, there's always people who respond to it. The problem is that if you're going to give something that's basically a placebo but has side effects, I'd rather be giving a placebo. Wellbutrin is another antidepressant, otherwise known as bupropion. It's very different from the SSRIs. People tend to have less carb cravings. It does have a seizure risk associated with it. There may be a place for it for some people, but it can make people irritable and not sleep well. Rosarum, Remalton, is for sleep, is a sleep medicine. It's basically like melatonin. I'm not a big fan of melatonin unless I know it doesn't come from a cow's brain, because that's where some of it has come from. So you want synthetic melatonin if you're going to use it. And the actual studies on melatonin are very mixed. That said, a lot of people use melatonin, and it works really well. But Rosarum, Remalton, is about 10 times more receptor affinity. It sticks better to your brain than melatonin. It might be even better for sleep. Costs more money, though. SNRIs, that's another class of antidepressants, including Effexor, Cymbalta, Remeron, Cirzone. Cirzone's only sold as Nefazodone now in the U.S. I don't use them a whole lot because a lot of people, when they use these regularly and then miss a dose, have some pretty bad withdrawal. I have the same problem with Paxil, actually, which is one of the SSRIs, except sometimes Remeron or Tazepine is really great at helping people sleep, and if they're not eating, it helps them eat. So that's good if you don't eat very much. So sometimes that has a place. I'll consider any of them if I need to, but probably mirtazapine is the one I use, but for that more specific use. Desaril or trazodone is a very old antidepressant that's often used to help people sleep. It does have cognitive side effects. People tend to not think as clearly during the day sometimes when they're taking this. And priapism is an issue. So it has kind of a Viagra-type or Cialis-type effect. It can give erections that don't go away, which can be dangerous. So similar to the commercial, you know, where they say, if an erection doesn't go away in 4 hours, seek medical help. Same thing with this stuff if that occurs. In low doses, it's usually not a problem. Buspirone, is an azaspirone medication. It's a very mild antidepressant medication. Again, a lot of people feel like it's kind of like a placebo. But one of the big problems is the serotonergic cross-reaction. So I want to just speak for a second about serotonergic cross-reactions. There's a thing called serotonin syndrome. Now, you remember we were talking about SSRIs before, serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitors. We didn't talk a lot about mechanisms, but they do increase the amount of serotonin in your brain. But there are a lot of other things that do, too. And if you're on an SSRI and you add Buspar, you might get too much serotonin, and that can be very dangerous. If you add an SSRI to an SNRI, that could happen. But also, getting back to the alternative and complementary medicine, if you add St. John's wort or SAMI to an SNRI or an SSRI or to Buspar, you could also get a serotonin syndrome. So it's just another reason to tell your doctor about everything that you're going to be taking, all the supplements, so that we can kind of figure out and make sure that you're not going to end up in trouble. Happened to be very recently, actually, with a whole different combination. I think it was omeprazole and an SSRI, where someone started sweating, which is one of the first signs of this serotonin syndrome, and I had to tell the family, gee, you know, the medicine you're giving is a bad combination. There are others that we use. Lithium sometimes is a great mood stabilizer. It's actually one of the only medicines proven to be anti-suicidal. It speaks to that whole connection between autism and bipolar disorder. You probably know this, but in families with autism, there's often bipolar disorder, there's often schizophrenia, there's often ADHD. Well, so if you're treating someone with significant mood instability with autism, sometimes lithium can work, but the hard part is you have to get a lot of blood levels, you have to watch thyroid and kidney function. Usually those change and you have to do something about them, but usually not permanently. It's confusing. Namenda, which is an Alzheimer's medication, is an antagonist of a glutamate receptor. The idea is that in autism, we think that there's a neuroinflammatory action going on, and if you have too much of this glutamic acid glutamate activity going on, it's bad for your brain. It's probably true that too much glutamate activity is bad for your brain. And these medicines damp that down and might help autism. So there have been a couple studies, mostly by Michael Chez, who think that this might be helpful for some people. I think the results are mixed. We have a lot of good theories, but we don't have a lot of great studies really showing whether these things work. There's a lot of reasons for why we don't have great studies, but I want to spend some time on your questions. There are medicines that I avoid a lot. Paxil because of withdrawal, Effexor because of drug withdrawal problems, Tegretol because, as I said, I can't make it work, the combination of Depakote and Lamictal because I can't get the levels to stay steady, Tricyclics, those old antidepressants. One of them, I'll point out, Anaphrinil, clomipramine, is really very good for OCD, but classic OCD. Not so sure about people on the spectrum. And you remember monoamine oxidase inhibitors because on cold pills it often says, call your doctor if you're taking an MAOI or monoamine oxidase inhibitor because they've got a lot of drug-drug interactions. But they can sometimes be useful. I want to just add one special caution on benzodiazepines. Those are the Valium class medicines, Valium, Ativan, Xanax, Klonopin, got the generic names there too. They're used so frequently by many doctors and many families, and they nearly always cause more problems than they're worth. They're addicting, they destabilize mood, and, you know, for our kids, we're trying to help them learn and have better motor function and better memory, and these medicines get in the way of that. So typically, it's not worth it. It's a little bit like taking a shot of booze. It's probably better than a shot of booze for you, but not much better, and in the long run, usually not worth it. Here's a very tiny copy of that abnormal involuntary movement scale. You can probably copy this with your grab function if you have a Mac and blow it up. But you can just Google it up and you'll find it. It just talks about the different things that your doctor should be checking. My form here has a number of different columns, so it'll last me 2 years checking every 6 months. But this is just a reminder that for all the people who are on neuroleptics, and there are more and more every day, we want to be watching for abnormal involuntary movements. So look at the whole picture, be careful with medications, and engage the child. That's kind of the bottom line here. I think that's my last formal slide, and I want to go to questions and answers. There have been a whole lot on the Internet, so I'll get to some of those, but I'm going to quickly check and see if there's anybody on the phone, because I kind of like to hear somebody else's voice at this point. Let's see. Well, there are some people on the phone. We've got Lisa, and we've got somebody else. So, Lisa, I'm going to unmute you. Hopefully, we can hear your question. Are you there? Maybe I have to unhold you. Let me try that. Okay. Are you there, Lisa? I can't hear you. Hello? Uh-oh. Well, I'm so sorry. But if you want to type in your question, and for the other person, since I'm having trouble with that, I will. I'm going to mute you again, and we'll just soldier on. So let me go to the other Q&A. Let's see. See all questions. See all approved questions.
Go to all questions.
All questions. Sorry about that. Thanks. All approved questions. I'm not seeing anything.
Go to all questions at the bottom.
Oh, okay. Here we go. Thanks. So, Brianna from Duluth. My 7-year-old is on trazodone. I was just wondering if one possible side effect is hunger. He seems to be hungry all the time, but I'm not sure if it's meds or just something that stems from his autism. Thank you. Actually, trazodone can make people hungry. In fact, as I said earlier, Topamax and Wellbutrin and the stimulants are probably the medicines that make people less hungry. Pretty much everything else can make you more hungry, maybe with the exception of Giadan. So, yes, it probably is the trazodone. You probably want to talk with your doctor about that. But also think about if the medicine's working really well, diet and exercise are often, you know, very, very helpful, and there's something that helps in lots of other ways, too. Tammy from Punxsutawney asks, My daughter is on Abilify, had previously been on Clonidine, but we took her off of it. She has extreme mood and behavior problems. She takes Trazodone at night, another Trazodone, which makes her tired for a couple hours of school. Right. My question is, would you recommend a stimulant in the morning? Well, perfect question, because this is, gets to chasing medications with other medications. You can bet that by using the Trazodone, that's what's making her tired early in the morning. If you start adding a stimulant, you're more likely to get more problems than what it's worth. If later in the day she's functioning pretty well and doesn't seem to need a stimulant, I would rethink the Trazodone thing. It's probably just lasting too long. Maybe the dose is a little bit too high. Maybe the Clonidine is not a bad idea to go back to. If it's not going to last as long, maybe Remalton, Rosarum is something to think about, because it doesn't tend to make people do that. So there's a bunch of different things to try, but I'd be very leery about adding a stimulant to it. I'd try to avoid that. That gets into polypharmacy versus combined pharmacotherapy. Great question. Thanks. Amy from Charlotte. How much Abilify do you usually prescribe to older children, 9 years? What are your thoughts of using Abilify along with Vyvanse for ADHD and Asperger's? Also, what are your thoughts on the safety of long-term use of low doses of Abilify? Are side effects more likely to appear after long-term use? Great set of questions. So the maximum I'll go to on Abilify is actually 30 milligrams, which is the official maximum for adults. And you say, Fader, these are kids. What are you talking about? Well, guess what? Now, I'm talking right now for children over about 3 or 4 and up through adulthood. When they're young kids, maybe 7, 8, 9 years old, their livers, pound for pound, are bigger than the rest of their bodies than for an adult. So they actually may be metabolizing medications more efficiently than they than an adult might be. So sometimes you actually need higher doses of medications. Now, the way that your liver metabolizes things is different when you're 3 and under. Things are a little dicier, and there are some changes that occur in adolescence as well in terms of how we metabolize medications, particularly in kidney function, and that is more for the Vyvanse. But that said, I'll go to 30 milligrams, but I'll use the minimum effective dose, and I keep trying to figure out what's the minimum I can use and get away with, because I don't want to use any more medicine than I have to. Long-term use, I worry about of any medication. That's why I do things like that abnormal involuntary movement scale. And I do think that some side effects may appear after long-term use. So, for instance, the longer you're on a neuroleptic medication, the more, like Abilify, the more likely, historically, people might get tardive dyskinesia. So that is an issue I think you have to watch for. Same thing with weight gain. That can, happen more and more over time. So something to think about. Using Vyvanse along with the Abilify, again, if you do it in a thoughtful way, I'm fine with that. Now, Vyvanse is expensive and fancy. I think, it's been very well publicized, so I think people are using it. I personally would go with generic Adderall XR before I go for Vyvanse, because it's cheaper and typically works just as well. Vyvanse was, it's a new form of a medicine to make it more expensive. It has to break down in your stomach, so it's harder to abuse if you're a teenager. If you have teenagers around, you're worried about using that. But, as with all things, you should lock up your medications. Just keep a couple out for the week. Even with your Motrin and Tylenol, those are toxic and overdose. I recommend people lock up everything, including their alcohol and things you could huff, but that's a story for another day. Lisa from New York, how do you handle an autistic who reads the side effects on the label and takes all of them quite literally, that each side effect is something that he will get? It is therefore resistant to medication even when it's needed. These are such great questions. Thank you so much, everybody, for these. It's a really common problem. If it's possible to look at the percentages, If you go to places like the PDR or to rxlist.com, lots of times you can get percentages of people who get the side effects. If it's going to be more than 10%, something like that, then that's a lot. But your child, out of 100 people, the likelihood of getting these things is less. And you might have to do some kind of help or test to help them understand that they might not get the side effects. So if you're looking at 10%, if you have like a pie chart and it's got slices that are each 10%, you can make that on your computer, and then you drizzle salt or sugar or something on top of it, and you say, gee, that's 10%. All these other people, all these other salt crystals aren't getting the side effect. You can say, you know, it's true that some people get that, but the likelihood that you'll get that is actually very small. And you can find instances in everyday life where some people get something and a lot of people don't. Might be with head colds. They're very catching. Almost everybody gets it in the family. But with side effects, a lot of people don't. So that might help. I mean, it's never easy, is it, with that? Now, the other side to that is that that's when complementary medicine comes into play lots of times, because if you can settle someone down and make them less vigilant with chamomile, if it'll work, sometimes it does, then maybe they'll be more open to thinking about the medication. Or even luckier, maybe with the chamomile, they won't need medication at all. Brianna from Duluth, I've got you again, but I'm going to go on to Brandy because she hasn't had a chance yet. Brandy from Tupelo says, are there any meds that four-year-old children can take for ADHD? Great question. So here's the thing. For ADHD, and we can extrapolate if we want to for autism, but you know it's going to be more complicated. The thing about being young is that your brain isn't as developed, right? So the neuronal tracts that we think are most important for stimulant medications for ADHD are these dopaminergic tracts in the front of your head. They help you quiet down the rest of your brain so you can focus and plan and do things. They're not very well developed when you're four. In fact, they're probably not very well developed until you're about six. And if you've got autism, they might not be very well developed because the connections between parts of your brain aren't quite as sorted out as they might otherwise be. And the surface of your brain might be relatively affected in sort of a pockmarked way, just genetically. Great information from Dr. Eric Corshane. Recently talking about this stuff. The paper is going to be coming out soon. Well, okay, so all that said, it's a little dicey expecting medications to work for young kids with ADHD. There was a pretty good study done, I think it's called the PAT study, done about 5 or 6 years ago that basically showed that in some kids, but not as many, the stimulant medications can work if it's really ADHD, but not a surprise, you're more likely to get side effects, sleep problems, irritability, appetite problems, things like that. So the answer is a qualified yes. The medications, the regular stimulant medications can work. But also, the guanfacine, clonidine, central alpha agonists may work a little bit. And some people try Strattera, but I'm not a big fan. Christy asks, should I medicate only for the benefit of school? Meaning, kids doing fine at home, but at school is having trouble. I think it's worth considering. If you think about the holistic picture, some situations are worth medicating for. Soccer, school, I think it's worth considering. It doesn't mean you always do it, and it doesn't mean you don't look at the situation. But just as an example, and this is the best example, is really from the ADHD world, a lot of times a stimulant medication isn't really needed at home because there isn't a whole lot of things going on at home that distract a person, but at school there are, and so the person seems to need medication, or they need more medication to get their work done at school than at home. This kind of thing is often the case. But that said, if someone's being mistreated, or people at school really aren't forming relationships with them, instead they're changing staff all day because they say, oh, well, the child needs to get along with all kinds of people, which, if you look at typical children and you change their staff all day, it freaks them out. So why would you do it with our kids? I don't know. But anyway, it's probably has to do with funding. Anyway, so if you've got a bad situation and you're trying to sedate the child with, like, Abilify because they're freaking out because people are changing all the time, well, that would be inappropriate. So look at the whole picture, try to figure out why the person is having the problem they're having, and think about ways that don't have to do with medication. We've got just 1 minute left and a whole lot of other questions, so let me just pick one other question, but say, again, feel free to send me your email address with any of these, and I'll be happy to email you back some answer to your question. So there's about 10 other questions. I'm just going to pick one more really quick. Heather from Port St. Lucie. I have a 5-year-old with autism and visual impairment. He was given Vyvanse to control some of his anxiety and ADD, all of Vyvanse. The side effects are so severe as he is very sensitive to most over-the-counter medications, too. They tend to make him more sensitive, sensory. What to do if a child has so many side effects? What drugs are better, if any? Great question. Go low and go slow. You have to be very careful with these medications. Some people would actually take more medication than you would otherwise expect. Some people, less medication. And sometimes you really have to look at the situation, occupational therapy with a sensory integration base. Are the people who are working with you working as a team and having team meetings to support each other? The answer is often, sadly, no. Is there somebody who can kind of be in touch with everybody to make sure that people get on the same page and are working together? So these are always complex problems with a whole bunch of different pieces to it and a whole bunch of different solutions, or a whole bunch of different pieces to the possible solutions. The solutions aren't perfect. Our outcomes aren't perfect. We hope that they're better or that they're good enough. I know I've got to stop now. I really appreciate the time talking with you. As I said, if you email me directly, I'll be happy to answer your questions. Thank you so much,
Dr. Fader. Now, can you tell everyone what your email is again?
Oh, yeah. Let me go back to that slide at the very beginning. Slides, come back. They're not coming back. Oh, here they are. Connecting to a server. It's jdfeder@pol.net, but I think it's up at slide like 3. Let me see. Is that the right slide? Slide 2. Here we go. Oops. Oh, well. jdfeder@pol.net.
Okay.
Thanks again.
Thank you so much. Remember, everyone, that this pre-recorded webcast will be available again on our Autism Conference weekend, Saturday, April 9th and 10th, so be sure to check it out. Everything's free. I wanted to mention that if you want a transcript of this event, you can join our Spectrum Gold Club by clicking the button on your screen, and we will be happy to send you a copy of the webinar audio and transcript, plus 29 other webinars when you join. Also, tell us what you think. Call us at 877-211-0212, extension 1, and leave a short comment or a testimonial. That number again is 877-211-0212. And I'm pre-recording another webinar tomorrow. It's Dr. Lori Ernstberger, who will be talking about girls under the umbrella of autism spectrum disorder, practical solutions for addressing everyday challenges. And I will be recording that tomorrow, I believe around 2:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, but we will be sending out a reminder just to be sure that we have the time right on that. So, but you can check back to the autism, momsfightingautism.com website for the actual time, probably later this evening. So thank you again, Dr. Fader. We really appreciate it, and I hope everyone joins us for the Autism Conference.
You're very welcome. Great conference.
Thanks so much.
Lots of it, too. Have a good night.
Thank you. You, too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.